Thank you to Scamfluencers and Lola Blankets for sponsoring this episode.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening.
Marley Liss is a survivor, award-winning speaker, victim advocate, somatic educator, and author from Toronto, Canada. She grew up in the arts but pivoted to social work when she began her college career. But it was in Marley's junior year when her life changed forever. She became the victim of a sexual assault and entered an arduous journey in the criminal justice system as a result. However, 3 years into that battle for justice, Marley found an additional path, restorative justice. According to Walden University, quote, "Punitive justice is the idea of punishing criminals for their crimes against society or the legal system itself, and is the traditional method of handling crime in the United States. Restorative justice seeks to bring victims of crime into the justice process. In restorative justice, criminals are asked to take accountability for their wrongdoing by facing those they've wronged. The theory is that criminals owe more than a debt to society. They owe a debt to specific people," end quote. The two processes are not always mutually exclusive, though. It's important to note that criminal justice can occur tandemly with restorative justice practices. The Broken Cycle Media team is so very grateful for Marley's powerful perspective, advocacy, and time and energy in sharing in this episode.
My name's Marley. I'm a bunch of things, which we all are. I'm a survivor and author. I have a background in social work and somatic healing as well. I'm a Sagittarius, I'm a dog mom, I'm a queer person. I'm the founder of a coalition called Survivors for Justice Reform, and I'm also a speaker. I'm from Canada, so I'm based in Toronto. I grew up here. A huge part of my life and upbringing was dance. It was really my first love, and I think it's how I processed a lot of things in the world without knowing that I was emotionally processing. I was always releasing so much through dance. I did competitive training, and obviously we always wanted to win first place, but my other measure of whether I did a good performance was, did I make my mom cry? Did I move her to tears? I think it was this idea of allowing ourselves to be moved by one another and to feel empathy and to embrace emotion. I think from a young age, I was able to see that empathy. I will say I had two very different parents. And I think in terms of restorative justice, the approach was very, when someone does something wrong, we sit down, we talk about it, we take accountability. And the other parent's approach was much more punitive. Grounding, shouting. So I think that also gave me insight into just different ways of responding to conflict and harm in the world. I was always fully set on dance. I was one of those kids that was like, I'm on this earth just to dance. Very big theater kid energy. I went to an art school and everything. So that was always my dream. Around the time I was finishing high school, I actually decided to pivot from a focus on dance to social work. I just started seeing what I would call rape culture and the ways also that a culture of objectification impacted people in my life. Specifically growing up in dance, there were so many people I was close with who started struggling with pretty severe eating disorders. That was something that I was navigating as well and was so consuming to me. Even though I hadn't experienced an obvious sexual assault at that point, I had a lot of those sort of blurry experiences of, was that consent? Was that coercion? That made me want to pursue a career that was more so focused on impact and change making beyond what could have been possible with dance. I decided to study social work and I went to a university in Toronto, enrolled in that program, and I didn't give up dance completely. So I did my university's dance team, which we still competed and everything like that. I will say I had this kind of Hannah Montana style double life happening because part of me was such a classic early 20s kid who was living in the city, drinking, partying with friends. And then the other part of me got really into like meditation, yoga, and self-help books. There was actually one summer before starting my third year of college, this unpredictable series of events led me to working at this meditation center on the West Coast. And the reason I share that is because it was this really powerful environment that was almost entirely women. And there was a really big focus on creating practices and a community and a lifestyle where women are centered. So I spent the whole summer in that context, reading and learning about feminism and things like that. I just felt so safe in that bubble. It was only a week after I got home that I ended up experiencing this assault. And I just want to give that landscape because it really was like being knocked out of this beautiful pink cloud into the most brutal reality. How that happened was unfortunately not a unique story. I was reuniting with friends after our summer all apart. We got together and we were drinking. We went to a club. I slowly started losing my friends throughout the night. We had a plan that I would sleep at this one friend's house. One of them got sick and she was like, I'm going to go home because she drank too much. And we were like, oh, we'll come with you. And she's like, no, just stay and I'll see you later. And then I was with the other friend where I was supposed to sleep at her place. I lost her as well because she started talking to this guy and she was like, I'm into him. And they kept talking. And I was like, I don't mind. I'll just go dance and have fun. And then this guy who was a stranger came up to me. I was sort of looking around the room. So he was just like, are you looking for someone? And I was like, yeah, I'm looking for my friend. I'm ready to leave. And he was like, oh, I'll help you look for her. At first, he was this really courteous, respectful guy who was just helping me look for my friend. And I didn't have any sexual interest or attraction. I was honestly ready to leave. We couldn't find her. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm just going to get a cab and go to her place because I at least know our one friend who had got sick and left was at their place and she could let me in. And when I got to the cab, this guy was like, what's the address? I'll tell the driver. And I said the address. And he was like, that's so weird. That's the condo I live in as well. And it was this really weird coincidence because he actually did live in the same building as them. And Toronto is a big city. Based on that, he was like, in that case, let's split a cab. I'll cover the fare. I was like, sure, sounds good. I'm a student. I'm happy to not have to pay for my taxi. But right when we got in the cab, he started being handsy and put his hand on my thigh and started moving it up. Right away, I said, I'm not interested in that. I'm really tired. I just want to get to my friends. We arrived at the building and I started calling my friend who I knew was in her unit and she wasn't answering. I kept calling and calling. She still wasn't answering. And that's when this guy was like, why don't you just hang in my unit until your friend answers and I'll get you a glass of water. You can just chill. Even though I've shared this story so many times, I still have a voice of self-blame pop up sometimes. Well, why would you go with a stranger into his unit? But we've also all had experiences of someone being perfectly kind. So I said yes and went to his unit. He grabbed me a glass of water and then left and gave me my space. Then he came back a minute later and really just did a 180 right away. He pulled my pants down and started to assault me. I remember saying, no, I don't want this. He just covered my mouth at that point and then continued assaulting me. It went on for a long time, like about 4 or 5 hours. I didn't realize it had been that long until after he had raped me. He went to the bathroom for a second. And at that point, I realized the sun had come up, meaning it was the next day. Something about that made me snap out of what I now know is freeze response and just grab my stuff and run out of there. After I ran out of his place, I was just in a complete state of shock. I remember looking in the mirror and being like, holy crap, that just happened. And I didn't know what to do. I told my one roommate who I was really good friends with. The two of us ended up literally Googling, what do you do after you're raped? And then we just went through those steps. It was like, write down what happened, put these clothes in a bag, go to the hospital and do a rape kit. So that's what I ended up doing is I went to the hospital. I did the rape kit process. It's such an invasive process, but the nurse I had was such an absolute angel. At the end of the rape kit, she asked me, would you like me to call the police so you can report, or would you like to just go home? That binary option of report to police or do nothing at all. I've done trainings now with sexual assault nurse examiners, and most of them share that they have never learned about restorative justice. And so they're presenting the options that they know about. At the time, I couldn't imagine doing nothing at all. And so that was really the catalyst behind me reporting. She called the police from there. I told them what happened, and then they drove me to the police station and we did a very clinical interview where I gave my statement of what happened. And right away, it felt very cold.
Hi, friends. We know that scams are everywhere, on your phone, in your inbox, even on your television screen. Looking at you, Tinder swindler. What is it about scams that has pop culture so obsessed? Or maybe it's because we're all deeply fascinated by the psyche of someone who can lie with ease, cheat with no guilt, and convince the world they are who they say they are, even when they're not. Scamfluencers is a weekly podcast that takes you into the world of deception, sharing the stories of today's most notorious scams, like the recent episode of Natalie Cochran, the pharmacist femme fatale. It seemed like she had it all, a good job, loving husband, and 2 kids. But behind the scenes, Natalie was scamming friends and family using fake contracts, fake government emails. She even faked cancer. But when the walls start closing in, she'll do anything to keep the lie alive until someone ends up dead. Listen to Scamfluencers now, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to Scamfluencers for sponsoring this episode.
I had everything written down, the details. I remember asking if I could just hand the police officer the piece of paper because I don't think I can explain it out loud yet. Now I can voice these things, but at the time I was opening my mouth to speak and nothing was coming out. The one male officer was like, yeah, no problem. And he took the paper, left the room, came back and said, that paper is being kept as evidence now, time for you to tell us what happened. It was like whiplash. So right away, there was this feeling of, this doesn't feel very caring or supportive while I'm in this trauma space. After I made the police statement, I heard from an investigator, and pretty soon after, we did a photo lineup. They basically showed me a bunch of photos and they said, which one is the person who did this to you, and I showed them. After that, it was radio silence for maybe a year and a half, almost 2 years. I heard almost nothing about what was happening with the process. I will never minimize the impacts of sexual trauma, but I didn't know the degree to which it would impact me. In the months after trauma, for the first time in my life, I didn't feel like I could dance, which was this really big loss, but I felt so mad at my body and disconnected from my body, and dance brought up too much for me. I was really struggling with panic attacks, suicidal ideation. My rape didn't happen on campus, but because I was a student at the time, I had access to this Office of Sexual Violence, and an advocate was supporting me. I told this advocate that I hadn't heard anything about my case, and she started making some calls. That's when I received an update that we were going to have a preliminary trial. That's basically a trial to see, is there enough evidence to do a criminal trial? So it had been 2 years between reporting and going to this trial. I really knew nothing going into it. A lot of states I know have this as well, but something we have in Ontario is survivors can access an hour or more of free legal advice at certain nonprofits. So I went to get this free hour of legal advice, and I was really hopeful that it would comfort my anxieties. But I got to this room and I was told, you're considered a witness in a crime that was done to the state. Any criminal case, if you look up the files or things, you're going to see the name of the accused versus the state. We talk about being victim-centered, survivor-centered. That's the opposite to me. And then the other part of it that's so harmful is, because we are witnesses ordered by the court to help them prove that a crime was done to the state, we are expected to act like cooperative witnesses, meaning we should answer. And this is something I was told in that legal session. If we don't answer a question on the stand, or we refuse to, or we're unable to, we could actually be charged and penalized as a non-cooperative witness. Then there's also the reality of trauma responses. I was still dealing with freeze response to such a big degree, and I was really scared that if they asked me a question and I opened my mouth to speak and nothing came out, would I then be penalized for having a trauma response? By the time I got to this preliminary trial, I knew all that. I remember sitting on the stand, and I was up there for 5 hours having my character and my sexual history and my actions all interrogated, while my assailant's just sitting in the crowd staring at the ground. And I remember the defense lawyer asking me these really invasive questions. He literally asked, how many thrusts per minute? The whole thing just felt so backwards. The preliminary trial, I got through that. And then every step I had taken in my healing, I felt like I was brought right back to square one. After that, I really started focusing on my healing again. And I put any thoughts about the justice process on the back burner. Another year went by. So that's 3 years total since reporting. Then I was subpoenaed for the criminal trial. And my very first thought was, I don't want to do this. I want to drop the charges. I don't want to go through another trial, especially knowing the rates of acquittal, how common it is that trials for sexual assault end with nothing at all. I had that thought in my head for about a week. In that time, I kept bawling my eyes out. I felt like I had dragged myself through all of this just for it to lead to nothing. The idea of going to court again was so painful, but the idea of doing nothing at all was also very painful. At that point, I had a friend ask me this question that became really pivotal. And I think it's a question that all of us deserve to be asked in our lives, or to ask survivors for sure, is, what would meaningful justice look like to you? When I answered that, I was pretty clear. I was like, I would want him to take accountability for what he did. I'd want to voice the impact in a completely uncensored way, because in the courtroom, we're not uncensored. I'd want to ask the questions that I've had for years and get some answers. I'd want him to do deep work to make sure that he doesn't do something like this again. My friend just said, like, you should try and make that happen. At that point, I started doing all kinds of research around, does anything like that exist? And that's when I found the words restorative justice. Restorative justice is almost like an umbrella term for any process that's prioritizing healing rather than just punishment. And so that can look many different ways. And the way it looks is based on what the survivor needs and wants. I had a need for accountability, dialogue, because I wanted to ask my questions, and reassurance he wouldn't do this again, which is where therapy came in. So restorative justice was pretty much a name for exactly what I described. Honestly, I felt two things. I felt really grateful because the path that I was really, really wanting had already been paved. I think it's important. Everyone knows restorative justice. It's not this new thing. It's actually a reclamation of very old practices that existed long before the criminal legal system, which really came with colonization. Indigenous communities have done restorative justice for a long time. And I was also really frustrated because I was 24 years old. I'd been going through the system for 3 years. I'd also studied social work, and no therapist, no rape crisis center, no nurse, no one had ever told me that another option exists. I went to my Instagram and I put up a story saying, does anyone know anything about restorative justice? And someone responded saying, I have a friend who knows this advocate who is passionate about restorative justice. That's how I got connected with this advocate who used to be a lawyer and now he's a restorative justice mediator. I told him my situation and he said, I'd like to help try and make this happen. Why don't you and I have a meeting with the prosecutors together and ask for this? So the two of us went and had this meeting with the prosecutors. It was a very polarized response. And I said, I don't want to go to criminal trial. I really want to do restorative justice. And I'm very adamant, there's no one size fits all when it comes to justice. So for me, the version of restorative justice that felt meaningful was I wanted my assailant to go to therapy extensively. And then I wanted us to meet in a circle, which is a facilitated dialogue. One of the prosecutors was very against it. She thought something was wrong with me. She was like, oh, honey, rape is bad. And I was like, I'm aware. I think it's so bad and we have to do something different because what we're doing isn't working. Look at rates of sexual assault that end with legal sanctions. We need more paths to justice. Her and I went back and forth for a while because she was very against it. Luckily, there was another prosecutor in the room named Kara. And at some point, she kind of leaned forward and said, I've been a prosecutor for nearly 20 years, and I constantly see victims re-traumatized, rapists acquitted. In the rare case that they are incarcerated, they often end up offending again. So I agree. We need to look at different options. I left the room that day and the two of them were actually fighting for the case. So it was either going to be that Kara got the case and we did restorative justice, or the other prosecutor got the case. And as she knew, I didn't want to go to criminal trial. So she was aware if she got it, we dropped the charges and nothing would happen. Luckily, Kara really fought for the case. And after another month of waiting, I got a call telling me that she got approval and this process was going to now pivot into restorative justice, meaning we weren't going to go to criminal trial anymore. My assailant was starting therapy right away, and he would do that for 7 months. And then we would meet in this circle process once everyone felt ready. Getting that phone call that this process was happening was probably one of the most healing moments for me, because it was the first time since the rape where I voiced my boundary and I voiced what I actually needed, and someone listened and acted accordingly. That was a really big point of grief for me after rape. I remember feeling like there was no point to even having a voice, because I remember saying no during the rape and my no was powerless. So that was so huge and profound. And every step of the restorative justice process was like that. All of the lead up should be deeply rooted in trauma-informed care and moments of consent like that too. So from that moment, my assailant began therapy. Because of confidentiality, I don't know everything he spoke about in his sessions, but we would hear some themes of what they were discussing. And that was really meaningful to me, because my assailant was doing this deep work around learning about consent, understanding why he had come to treat women in the way that he did, learning about power dynamics, challenging toxic masculinity and norms within hookup culture, and challenging the entitlement towards women's bodies that he'd learned. And after 7 months of him going through therapy, we decided we were all feeling ready to have this circle process. Restorative justice is very survivor-centered, meaning that it's constantly turning towards the survivor and asking questions of, who do you want to have in the circle? What would help this room feel more safe for you? Are there any triggers that we can safeguard against? It's basically safety planning that happens leading up to the circle. But the survivor is constantly put in that driver's seat. So I got to decide who did I want in the circle. And that included my assailant. I asked for him to have either a family member or a close friend, because I wanted someone to be there to help hold him accountable more deeply so that he couldn't just walk away and forget that this ever happened. And then my mom and my sister were also in the circle to support me, but also because they were impacted, because trauma ripples. And then there was two mediators that would facilitate the whole thing. So that work is never put on the survivor. They did prep. They met with each of us one-to-one. They did lots of work to safeguard and make sure it felt as supportive as possible. When we got to the actual day of the circle, it was still scary. It was still really hard. But the contrast between court and that process was truly night and day. It blew my mind in terms of how healing it was. And they really just asked us one question, which was, what brought you here today? And we went around the circle just naturally 3 times answering that. And I was finally able to get all of the impact out of my body, like voice everything without censoring myself. I was finally able to ask those questions and name how much this impacted me while looking him in the eye. And then I got to hear answers, and not necessarily neat, perfectly packaged ones, but answers of what led him to justify this degree of violence. And a lot of it did come back to rape culture and growing up as an athlete and having a peer group that really normalized that. It was really, really powerful. And then he did take accountability. He did look me in the eyes and say, I'm sorry, I sexually assaulted you, and there's nothing I can do to take it back, but I hope that being here today can help. For some people, those might sound like just words or not enough. But again, I think we're so trained to focus on what is the perpetrator doing. But if we actually turn back toward me, the survivor in that moment, that was a really big moment for me. It literally felt like this knot untied in my stomach, and I just started crying these tears of relief. We didn't even wrap up at that point. It was like, okay, now we've looked back. Now we get to look ahead. What happens going forward? What kind of people do we want to be in the world? How can he do better? How can he continue to not just say sorry, but be a better person in the world. By the time it ended, I felt like I let go of 100 pounds of trauma. Honestly, it sounds really weird if you weren't there, but I felt happy. I felt just in awe of the fact that this really ugly, horrible, painful thing had been transmuted into something that was actually healing. That's why I'm so passionate about giving people an example of, hey, here's what my process looked like. So for me, the therapy and the circle made a lot of sense. For someone else, they might want the person who assaulted them to do volunteer work and write reflective essays on how they're working toward being a safer person in society for a full year. It could be a virtual circle. It can also be a surrogate process. Let's say a survivor doesn't want to meet their assailant in a circle, or maybe their assailant has passed, or their assailant ran away and they don't know their name or something like that. There's something called surrogate circles. That's when a survivor can meet with someone else who caused similar harm and is taking accountability. There's an amazing TED Talk from Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, and she's a survivor of rape, and she did that process. So she met with a man who wasn't her assailant, but he was a sexual offender who was now taking full accountability. They did a circle process, and she shares really similar to how I do in terms of what it meant to her. So I just want people to know that there's many different options that exist, and that the process is about identifying your needs as a survivor and creating a justice approach around those needs. That became the catalyst for me to be loud about this. Even though it's not for everyone, survivors deserve to know this option exists and then to choose if it's right for them.
Thank you again to Lola Blankets for sponsoring this episode. It's rare that I come across a product I wish everyone knew about, but that is exactly how I feel about Lola Blankets. The moment I opened the package for our new Lola blanket, I fell madly in love, and I knew the blanket fights would start immediately. And boy, was I right. Our new large Lola blanket in Shoreline is the most coveted item in our whole entire home. Especially leading into colder weather, it is the perfect addition to our couch and our binge nights. Because of their delicious softness and incredible size, Lola blankets have become my favorite new housewarming, baby, and even wedding gift. They're truly fit for gifting for any occasion. Lola is the world's number one blanket, crafted with ultra-soft, luxury vegan faux fur and a signature four-way stretch that sets it apart. It's machine washable, double hemmed for durability, and stays flawless. No pilling, no shedding, even after repeated washes. It's the kind of quality you can feel the moment you touch it. And during the holidays, it's the kind of gift that feels extra special because you know it's going to last for years to come. I have the large. It's perfect for cozying up solo or with someone else. Extra large is massive. They call it the biggest blanket on the internet. To add, Lola has over 10,000 five-star reviews, and once you feel it, you'll know why. There is a reason it's called the world's number one blanket. This thing is seriously next level. Give the gift of softness this holiday season and experience the world's number one blanket with Lola Blankets. For a limited time, our listeners are getting a huge 40% off their entire order at lolablankets.com. by using code WCN at checkout. Just head to lolablankets.com and use code WCN for 40% off. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them What Came Next sent you.
In the months after trauma, I remember I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I would just start writing. It was like I was getting these really destructive thoughts out of my head and onto paper, and almost like something in me had to find an outlet. Writing was one of the most healing tools for me after trauma and continues to be. I self-published a poetry book a year after the rape, and I was only 22, and that one was just totally, I say, like PTSD vomited onto paper. I just had to get that out of my body. I journal every day. I just finished writing my book about my story of restorative justice, and the process of writing itself, I find, is just so cathartic. And similar to dance, we can take these horrific experiences and turn it into something with artistry. That doesn't mean it's a rainbow and sunshine picture book. Just the act of turning it into something artful, I think, is really beautiful. I have romanticized every single step of this writing process, but I think that's something I've had to do in order to get it done. I've really enjoyed and found some healing in every single step, and that did include writing the proposal. It was a pretty robust proposal. It ended up being like 100 pages. It doesn't need to be that, so I don't want to intimidate anyone, but that's just what I did. It ended up including 5 sample chapters, a full chapter outline, a summary. I also had a section that said, why this book? Why now? That one, I sold off a proposal. I think most people either don't know restorative justice exists, or they know it exists, but there's a lot of misconceptions around it. That's because of such a lack of representation. What's kept me sharing about it, it's led to thousands and thousands of messages from survivors literally around the world saying, I wish I knew about this. I've heard from survivors who went through court and it led to an acquittal and they wish they knew about another option. I've heard from survivors who didn't go to the police because they didn't want the person who abused them, maybe it was a family member or a friend, to be incarcerated, or they were afraid of tearing their community apart, and so they did nothing. The many survivors, especially queer, trans, Black, Indigenous survivors, who didn't feel safe going to the police, and so they were left without options, and they wished they knew about this. So to me, that's been the most important sort of voice and message that I've heard in response to sharing my story. And that's been the fuel for me in continuing to be loud about this.
Can you share any words of advice or encouragement or wisdom for listeners who might relate to your journey? Or even if they haven't navigated the same experiences, maybe they've experienced similar emotions.
I would just say, really listen to your gut. And if something feels really wrong to you, you shouldn't have to go with that. For me, that happened through the justice system. I started going through this process and it was so re-traumatizing. But for a while, I was gaslighting myself and I was like, well, this is just what you're supposed to do after trauma. And apparently, this is just what survivors have to go through for justice. But the result was that I was harming myself and crossing my own boundaries again and again. And it took a lot for me to be like, it doesn't matter how many people are giving this system the stamp of approval. I deserve something better. And I want all survivors to know that what your gut is telling you matters. And ideally, you're surrounded by at least one person who's going to help you identify what you actually need and advocate for that. Because it really just took one person asking that question of, what would meaningful justice look like to you? And when I responded, she didn't say, that will never happen. She was like, that's valid. You should make that happen. So really just validating what your body's telling you, trusting that, and either acting accordingly or finding someone to help you act on it.
I absolutely agree. And all of that advice can be applied even if they choose to remain within the legal system and fighting through the criminal justice process. They can still listen to their gut, and an advocate goes a long way to educate us on what our boundaries are.
You're absolutely right. It doesn't just apply to the criminal justice system. Even in the world of true crime, I've had experiences where reporters are interviewing me and they're asking really invasive questions. And at first I would be like, well, I guess this is just how reporting is. And if you want your story to be out there, you're going to have to share it in this way. But then there's my gut's telling me that isn't right. And I'm going to advocate for something different. And it's led to experiences like this one where we're doing this interview. And I'm like, this is how reporting and storytelling should be done, and it doesn't have to be this exploitative thing. So just to say, that lesson can be applied to any area of our life.
Thank you for your time and your energy. Where do you want to guide people to support you?
I share resources and show up all the time on Instagram. Marley Liss, MarleeLiss is my Instagram. Same handle on TikTok. And I really am on there chronically. So feel free to reach out, say hi, ask questions. I'm always happy to hear from people. And then I also formed a coalition called Survivors for Justice Reform. That's also on Instagram. We have a website too. And that's a global coalition of survivors of sexual violence and domestic violence, as well as allies who are all advocating for restorative or transformative justice. Basically recognizing there's no one size fits all when it comes to justice, and we deserve multiple pathways that are truly trauma informed. So if anyone wants to get involved with that, you can participate as much or as little as you like. You really just go to our website and fill out the form there. We have an amazing WhatsApp group where people are building friendships and connecting and sharing resources every day. We have monthly skill shares. And then the last thing I'll say is that I do have a restorative justice resource guide. So if you or a loved one would benefit from resources around restorative justice, that guide is at marleeliss.com/resource. And it includes organizations around the world, books, podcasts, documentaries on this topic, and so much more.
I just appreciate you so much for your time and your energy and your advocacy.
Thank you so much. It's been so lovely connecting with you. And I really meant what I said in that moment of this is how getting survivor stories out should be done, because there's just care and humanity at the center.
According to the Department of Justice, quote, for every 1,000 sexual assaults, 50 reports lead to arrests, 28 cases lead to felony convictions, and only 25 perpetrators are sentenced to incarceration. Among college-age women who experience sexual violence, 20% of college students and 32% of non-students report to law enforcement. For those seeking more information about restorative justice, visit National Association of Community and Restorative Justice at www.nacrj.org. In collaboration with the National Center on Restorative Justice at Vermont Law and Graduate School and the Center for Restorative Justice at University of San Diego, the NACRJ have a helpful worldwide map of organizations, education institutions, and other entities across the United States that offer restorative justice services and resources. The map is linked in the episode notes.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I got into wrongful convictions after I did the reporting on Suave Gonzalez, who I won the Pulitzer for at the podcast Suave, which was about him. Particularly, this was about juvenile lifers, children mandatorily sentenced to do life in prison. Suave is in prison for a crime he admits he did. I got really close with him, and I learned so much through Suave. I very quickly learned about redemption and how none of us are the worst thing we ever did or happened to us. He said to me one day, there's a lot of people in here, Maggie, who didn't actually do the crimes they're in here for. And then I start thinking about these people who never did anything and are spending their lives in prison.
Thank you again to Scamfluencers and Lola Blankets for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget, listen to Scamfluencers now wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, for a limited time, our listeners are getting a huge 40% off their entire order at lolablankets.com by using the code WCN at checkout. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them What Came Next sent you.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.